Welcome to another edition of Expanding Minds. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. In the summer of 1985, I, a young lad at the time, lived with my high school girlfriend in Berkeley, California. And we lived in the notorious Barrington Hall, which was a student co-op that by that point had degenerated far out of control into a hive of drug dealing, occult weirdness, and various post-hippie zones of weirdness. Which was an entertaining place to live. And just to add some force to the experience, I decided to start my occult studies that summer, reading Aleister Crowley and getting to know the Thoth deck, and plunging through Illuminatus, the great conspiratorial Shaggy Dog tale by Robert Anton Wilson and Robert Shea, which came out in 1975. And Wilson, of course, lived in Berkeley in the early 70s when he was polishing up Illuminatus. So needless to say, it was a summer of high weirdness. But like many people who encounter these crazy Illuminatus books, I was most intrigued with the mention of a peculiar text with the name Principia Discordia. And so shortly thereafter, I believe it was the following year, I stumbled across a version of the Lumpanix yellow copy of this strange classic, perhaps certainly one of my favorite books, certainly one of the greatest books of the 20th century, with a peculiar influence at once marginal and mysterious, vaguely rumored, barely appearing in libraries and card catalogs, but also incredibly pervasive and prophetic. We can talk more about it later in the show, since we'll be focusing on the Principia Discordia and the whole Discordian story today with crackpot historian Adam Gorightly, one of my favorite writers on fringe topics today, who has recently come out with Historia Discordia, The Origins of the Discordian Society, which for people who are interested in these matters is a treasure trove of marvels. Tons of scans of all the crazy forms of printed expression that was associated with this joke masquerading as a religion, or perhaps a religion masquerading as a joke, which is only one of the many peculiar entrees and closed traps that leads you into the Principia Discordia. But before we go on, and we'll get more details on the book from Adam, I did want to announce that I am a pope in the Discordian church. No one knows this because I am Pope Jude the Extremely Obscure. And so I just wanted to, I felt compelled to announce my own participation in the propagation of this marvelous religion that is not a religion, this joke that is no joke. And with that, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
Are you a pope in the Discordian church?
Is it okay to be a female pope?
It's you could be whatever you want to be.
I know. That's really the whole point, right? Is that there's no rules. Everything's allowed.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. You recently had a story on Reality Sandwich.
I did, yeah. They just put up, I wrote a piece on dreaming, and interestingly enough, the topic matter is psychogenic fugues, which I just really like that word, psychogenic fugue. And the idea of a psychogenic fugue is like an alternate personality kind of, or someone else that you have hanging out that's you, but like you can only get access to sometimes. So in my article, I talk about how we all have a psychogenic fugue, which is like our dream identity or our dream self that we disassociate from our regular selves every night and then go and do all this crazy dream stuff as our other fugues or our other identities. So a lot of what I think, giving ourselves things like even a moniker such as a false pope, like you mentioned, is kind of creating these fugues for ourselves that create these other archetypal identities that allow us more freedom to kind of do whatever we want and break out of the concepts of who we think we are just by affixing titles or identities to ourselves.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. It's like that there. I mean, in a way, that's kind of the Pope move. Is that there are if the rules of reality get sufficiently warped or redeployed, and that might happen partly through, you know, physiological experiences like dreaming, and it might also happen through, you know, collective ritual experimentation with changing social rules. That different kinds of identities can come up. And the funny thing about these sort of invented identities is that they have more consistency than you might think.
True.
You know, my wife, who does a lot of dream work, she talks a lot about the sort of second self in the dream world, that there's actually a consistency to who she is, even in all these very different kinds of dreams. It's like a very much along the lines of what you're talking about, that we have these multiple identities that appear in different kinds of constructs, and then they have their own things to say, their own paths to pursue.
Exactly. And people don't think about it that much, but if you start examining even like why people join societies, for example, like why would people form together and have societies that confer titles, like even mayor, or like even if you're just looking at like an Elks Lodge or something, right? Like you can be a head lead member of the Elks Lodge, and then what is that? That's some kind of fugue that you're giving yourself. But what meaning does that have to say, like the mayor or something? Maybe not so much, right? It's all context.
Exactly. Well, that's great stuff. Let's bring Adam on to the show now. Adam, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me in Hail Eris.
Hail Eris, indeed. I just got to say, I'm going to try to not geek out too much in this show because, I have been a fan of this material for a long time, and I just can't tell you how delighted I was to see this book. I mean, for those of you who are familiar with the lore, it contains a scan of the very first edition of the Principia Discordia, which I never thought I would seed. There were only five copies, and they were originally thought to all have been lost, but one was found, and it's sort of an interesting parable. And then just tons of amazing material, extremely funny, and a lot of information. But for folks who don't know this great lore, I want to hand it to you to give us a little sense of, you know, you meet somebody on the street, and they're like, what? What's the Principia Discordia, Adam? Help us out here. Give us a thumbnail on this impossible to summarize text.
Yes, it is impossible, but I'll give it a whirl. It all came about when a couple of young teenage lads, Kerry Thornley and Greg Hill, who lived in Southern California, Whittier, California, to be exact. This was in the late 50s, and they were they became friends in high school. Greg was a couple years younger than Kerry. And so they were into a lot of crackpot, quote-unquote crackpot stuff. They used to go out and attend meetings of flying saucer cults and stuff like that. And they were interested in a lot of things, as well as philosophy and poetry. And so oftentimes they'd meet in a certain bowling alley, which later became a holy bowling alley when they had the vision of Eris there, the Greek goddess of chaos and discord, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So anyway, they'd have these discussions, and in the Principia Discordia, or Principia Discordia, people pronounce it different ways. It's mentioned that they met in bowling alleys, and they were sipping coffee when they started this debate about chaos and order in the world. I learned later the reason they went to bowling alleys is they could actually buy beer there as underage kids and hang out at odd hours. And so anyway, they started this conversation about order and chaos in the world. And Thornley's position basically was that order in the world, basically order emerged from chaos. There was really no order in the world. It was just the prevailing form of chaos. Order was just another type of chaos. For instance, the madness that came out of the Pentagon, which some seem, quite orderly, was, you know, just another form of unleashing chaos on the world. Whereas Greg Hill, his position was that basically order was projected on the universe, you know, by human perception, and it didn't really even exist. It was just the creation of the human mind. It had nothing to do with what was going on out there in this completely chaotic universe. And so, as you know, most religions in the world are trying to explain why there is order in the universe. They got discussing, well, there's no religion to explain all the chaos in the world. Thus, they came up with this quote-unquote spoof religion, Discordianism, and formed the Discordian Society. In the Principia Discordia, they talk about a vision they had at this bowling alley, the Brunswick Shrine, where Eris appeared to them and commanded them to go forth and spread the word of Discordianism to the world. So that was 1958, roughly. In years to come, they started working on the Principia Discordia. It was basically letters passed back and forth, and they're coming up with this theology and all these different elements of Discordianism. And, you know, basically it was a joke, a way to poke fun at organized religion. And eventually this material came together in the Bible of Discordianism, Principia Discordia, and the first edition in 1965, which only five were produced, and everybody assumed it was pretty much lost. Pages from it have turned up over the years, but after the Discordian archives were passed on to me, I really wasn't aware until after a couple of weeks. I was going through all this material and pulled this thing out and started looking through it, and I go, holy crap, this looks like the first edition of the Principia Discordia, which everybody thought was long gone. And flipping through it, I got to the last page, and sure enough, it said, this is copy 1 of 5.
That's amazing.
Must have been a great feeling.
Oh, yeah, kind of, very strange how I stumbled into all of this.
Well, it's fascinating to look at the first one. It's very different than later editions. You can really see, you know, a lot of labor putting into constructing this organization. Like it really is more, looks like more like a religion in the sense that it's outlining doctrine, it's outlining the structure, the different orders. Coming up with sigils badges for each of the different orders. So he's really like constructing a whole kind of, social cosmology of this peculiar religion. Whereas in later editions, the ones that people are more familiar with, it's much more chaotic. There's rubber stamps and cartoons with different, words beneath them, all sorts of different kinds of typefaces, names, quotations, contradictions, scribbles. You know, it's much more this kind of melange of different kinds of elements. What accounted for that shift? What was it that led this sort of early vision, which is, you know, written mostly in just straight text, into this rich visual stew of weirdness?
Well, there's a lot of structure there, you know. They're putting all this together, and at one point, it was 65, that edition came up, and it started to evolve, and in the late 60s, Greg decided to kind of blow up that structure. He didn't want it and became more of an art project. And then, you know, there's different people that got involved and joined the Discordian Society, you know, some of the more famous ones, Robert Anton Wilson, Robert Shea of the... who wrote the Illuminatus trilogy, and of course there's all kinds of references to the Discordian Society in there. Robert Newport, Camden Benares, Louise Lacey, who else, a guy named Bob McElroy. And so all of that input went into subsequent editions of the Principia Discordia. By the time they got around to the fourth edition, yeah, it was nothing like the first edition. I also want to note that also discovered in the Discordian archives is the paste-up of the fourth edition, where you can see how Greg actually put it together, and that's going to be another book project down the line I think people will be most enthused about.
Well, one of the things that really impresses me about the later editions, and it's partly why I asked about that development, is just that you can, even though, you know, we think of books as being like they have one author, or maybe it's a collection of essays by different authors, or the work of one artist, or a few artists who are related, or whatever. But when you read the Principia, it's sort of like, who wrote, where did this come from? How did one mind do, no, and it's not one mind. It's a reflection, and that's why the paste-ups would be really interesting. It seems to me that it's very much a reflection of the fact that this was a collaborative enterprise. And it was a collaborative enterprise where everyone was given as much creative freedom as they wanted to take in this sort of propagation of this joke metaphysics that is serious but not serious, and sarcastic but also in some very strange way kind of pure. And people, you know, so that there was all of, and people were sending letters back and forth. There's this sense of a real kind of collaborative print world that's manifested in it. That's really like nothing else.
Yeah, they started this letter writing circle with all these different folks who all had their Discordian names, you know, like there was Wilson was Mordecai the Foul, and there was a guy named Roger Levin, he was Fang the Unwashed, and of course Greg Hill was Malaclips the Younger, and Kerry Thornley was Omer Chaim Ravenhurst, and by the way, I'm a Pope too, I'm the Wrong Reverend Houdini Kundalini of the Church of Unwavering Indifference. But getting back to the letters, they had these things called groovy packs. So they'd put them together, and they'd have a list of names on there, and you'd throw whatever, something humorous or whatever you've written, or something you'd, something clipping out of the newspaper, or who knows what, and you'd send it off to the next person on the list, and they'd add to it and send it so that circulate around, and Greg Hill would finally get what came back. And a lot of those type of things, you know, it was like an art project. That type of stuff went into the Principia Discordia.
Right.
Well,
so
and let me ask you, I'm just curious, because within that kind of formulaic way to accumulate and amass information, it strikes me a lot similarly as to things that, like, the Surrealists were doing, particularly, like, André Breton and some of his groups with some of their, the ways they would sort of operate, or even, you could even compare a little bit to, like, how H.P. Lovecraft did the Cthulhu stuff, right? And how they, there was just this openness of creative exchange within a group of people, and then they would use kind of those, like, narrative corpsey techniques to accumulate the data.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not that familiar with how the Surrealist worked, but yeah, that was the process, and it was very mysterious, the Principia Discordia. It was, you know, once again, the first one was five copies. Then as they got to the fourth edition that was published by Ripoff Press. I'd have to refer to my notes, but it was like 500 copies that went out into the world, and, and it was in the underground, you know, the subculture of the period. So, you know, and nobody knew who, you know, who's Mal Eclipse the Younger, and, it, you know, this had a very small audience. Then when the Illuminatus trilogy came out in, like, 76, it was dedicated to none other than Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley, and there's all kinds of references to Discordianism in the Principia Discordia in the book. And a lot of people assumed, well, there's no such thing, you know, they're just making all this stuff up. There was also another text, Discordian text, mentioned in Illuminatus called The Honest Book of Truth by Omar Khayyam Ravenhurst, and there was some snippets taken from that. But once again, you know, people, you read that. I remember when I read Illuminatus, I knew nothing about Discordianism, who Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley were, so a lot of it was just went over my head. But, you know, as time progressed, people were, you know, asking, does this book really exist? And one of those was Michael Hoy with Loom Panics, and I think that's how that edition came about. And that was the first one Loom Panics put out was around 1978. And there's a couple of Loom Panics editions, actually. Once again, I discovered these in the archives. Most are familiar with the yellow cover, but prior to that, there was a white cover that had an introduction by Mike Hoy. So it, you know, reached a larger audience because of Illuminatus, and of course, in the years to come, you know, Discordianism has a huge presence on the internet and throughout the world. There's this young Australian guy, a friend of mine, who's actually writing a book on modern-day Discordianism and the history, and he's traveled all around the world to interview Discordianism, and his name's, and this is a real name, Brenton Clutterbuck, not a made-up name, and his book is Chasing Iris, and he also helps with this Historia Discordia website. He'll put up an article now and then. But anyway, this all emerged from a bowling alley conversation back in 1958.
Well, one of the things about that influence, just to you know, for people who are just kind of hearing about this, is that it's not just a bunch of wacky stuff that people did in the 60s and 70s. As you said, it really has had quite a pervasive influence, not just, you know, everything has a presence online these days, but Discordianism was part of a much earlier cultural DNA of what we could call, you know, online culture, internet culture, alternative culture online, and that a lot of the more creative early thinkers in who were realizing that the internet and computer networks, even virtual reality, were things that were going to open up human possibility and create some very strange situations. A lot of these folks were really influenced by this. There's a kind of current of sort of psychedelic, sort of satirical, interested in aspects of mysticism, but very, very critical of religion, interested in technology, but this sort of a trickster feel that was very much a part of some of the earlier layers of computer culture. And today, I think people who are just, you know, who came up younger into the internet, the way you'd really taste that current is on a site like Boing Boing. Like, if you take Boing Boing back, you're going to find it very much emerging from a Robert Anton Wilson Discordian place, where you're interested in all sorts of weird phenomena, interested in altered states and in rumors of UFOs and crackpot theories, but at the same time, you always keep one foot, like, firmly grounded in an amused skepticism about the weirdness of reality. So I, even though these are very obscure texts, hardly, and you know, they were, it's a very underground story for the most part, I also think it's quite prophetic. And one other element of the the prophetic element in the sense that there's something about this way of looking at the world that is presages or, you know, kind of anticipates where we are. But another element that we didn't mention is one of the reasons that the Principia Discordia has so many different versions is that it's anti-copyright. It's instead of the usual copyright symbol, in some editions you have, instead of the C, you have a little K for Callista or Chaos, and it says all rights reversed, which is a hilarious joke, both referring to all rights retained in the normal copyright claim, but also being a sort of an occult gesture towards doing everything backwards. And, you know, all of the sort of associations with that. So it's a brilliant move, and they're really anticipating a world where culture's made by splicing and repurposing and recirculating as much by some original mind who's creating some great vision. So even though it was very original, it always felt open and sort of dispersed, and in that way it actually ended up being more infectious in my mind. So I think it's really quite a significant text, and I just wanted to say that because, yeah, as we go through these interesting stories, there, you know, there are real strong reasons to take this stuff, I won't say seriously, but to take it on. But the question I wanted to ask you is, you know, you've written a separate book about Carrie Thornley, a fascinating character. I mean, we could spend, that's a whole other radio show, and I do want to talk about him a little bit, but there's been less written about Greg Hill, and particularly, you know, I want to say, like, where he was coming from. I mean, in addition to being this very creative mind, and, you know, he ran a cinema in Northern California, but he was also, he worked for Bank of America for 23 years doing, you know, software development. And so I'm like, where, you know, he is a more mysterious figure to me, even than Thornley, who's obviously a very trickster character. But I know less about Greg Hill. So can you just give me a sense of what was he like? How did he change through this process? Was it, you know, how did he relate to it? I'd really love to know.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, for a long time, and even to this day, some people don't believe that Greg Hill existed, that he was, maybe Carrie Thornley was calling himself Greg Hill, and you still see a lot of that. And, of course, I discovered, he did exist, and I met a lot of his friends who loved him dearly. He died in 2000 of esophageal cancer, and he had his demons. He was a very introspective fellow. Thornley was an extrovert, but Greg was an introvert, and was, you know, you're right on with how he was ahead of his time, you know, with the copy left, and a lot of people now I'm talking to are pointing towards this was an early stage of, you know, what's developed with Creative Commons and these type of things, and with the technology going through a lot of this material, I'm showing it to other quote-unquote nerds, and they're going, wow, how the hell did he do that? He must have had some type of early computer technology to make these different documents and things he was doing. So Greg was dialed into all that, you know, he saw what was coming. Of course, you know, what the Discordian Society was an early version of what, how the internet developed. But Greg himself, a little background, he was a couple of years younger than Carrie Thornley. They, after they graduated from high school, they moved to New Orleans for a period, and that's where they really got rolling with getting more involved with the Discordian Society, started a chapter there. Then Greg was in the Army for a few years, and there's some interesting things he's written about that experience, which I'll share at some point.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a moment.
Yeah. And so then he landed in... back in San Francisco, and that's after he got out of the Army. That was like 69 or so. And he was very interested in the counterculture, experimented with psychedelics. A lot of his writings were commenting on the counterculture, where it was heading, what was going on. He did a lot of writing that really hasn't emerged. One was a thing called Etcetera Pacifica that he sent out for a while that basically documented what was going on in the counterculture, and his friend in New Orleans published some of those articles, and his friend Roger Levin, who was also in the Discordian Society, published some of those articles in a magazine he had there called The Ungarbled Word. So anyway, they started the letter writing circle, and the Principia Discordia came about. And then by the he was also would get very depressed at times, and that we talked about. He ran a theater in Northern California. They had quite a scene going on there in the Russian River, where they had, it's basically a community ran theater, and they put on free concerts and feed the homeless. So he's tuned into all that stuff. But then he broke up with his wife at that time, got highly depressed, ended up in New York for some reason, and was there for a few years and didn't hear a whole lot from him. And then back in California, and around, he worked for B of A for 23 years, Hell Iris, before he died. So I think it's from like 1977 through 2000, kind of removed himself from, you know, the whole doing a lot of Discordian activities. But, you know, it's always a part of him, that's for sure.
Well, we're going to have to take a break right now. I got a ton of other questions coming up. I'm sure Maja has some. So, but we'll be right back. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Maja Dawu. We're talking with Adam Gorightly about the Discordian Society. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Minds from the Progressive Radio Network. Hi, this is Maja Dawu here with Eric Davis, and we're talking about Discordia with Adam Gorightly. And before the break, you were kind of just giving us a nice little rundown of Greg Hill and some of his background, and you had mentioned in there a little bit about your personal experiences with it. I wonder if you could maybe share with everyone one of your profound personal experiences with the Discordian philosophies after you surrendered your eyeballs to them. What kind of, like, effects did that have on you?
A lot of synchronicities went down when I wrote the the book on Carrie Thornley. That was back in the early 2000s, and I guess that experience will tell you a lot. Thornley's an interesting character, and I was, we can talk more about him at a later time, but I became interested in Thornley. This is before I knew anything about Discordianism, really. I talk about it a little bit here and there, but I was more fascinated by Carrie Thornley. His name, it's been floating around in conspiracy theory type circles, and he was, according to Jim Garrison, involved in some way in the JFK assassination. He knew Oswald in the Marines and was actually writing a book about Oswald 3 years before the Kennedy assassination. And so there's a lot of weirdness about Thornley's life. And back in the early 90s, a fellow wrote a book called Conspiracy Cover-Ups and Crimes. His name's Jonathan Vankin. And there was a chapter about Thornley, and Vankin said, it was a great chapter, and Vankin talked about writing a book on biography of Thornley at some point. And so, yeah, I was slavering, waiting for that. I thought that'd be great. Vankin never got around writing it, so anyway, that's why I got started collecting the material on Thornley and around in the late 90s, decided to write the book. So in 2000, I received a rather cryptic email. And this email came to an address that is not a public address. Mainly family and a few friends know it. But anyway, I got an email here from a guy named Robert Newport telling me that Greg Hill had died in July of 2000. You know, that's curious. So I replied back to that. I have no idea how he got my email. I don't to this day, but I replied back asking him, did you know Carrie Thornley, too? And he said, yes, I was friends with him in high school. Interesting. And he said he was also a founding member of the Discordian Society. So we started the correspondence, and I ended up meeting with Bob Newport at Robert Anton Wilson's place. This was in 2000. And he, Bob Newport, brought an armload of materials, which he was calling the Discordian Archives. And so went through this stuff, and he let me take it home with me, and I scanned it and used some of that material for the Prankster and the Conspiracy, the book on Carrie Thornley. And I told him, you know, I got the material back to him, and I said at one point, you know, what you shared with me would make a great book. And would you be cool with me doing that at some point? He was fine with it. He said, yeah, it'd be great. His plan originally was to put up a website with a lot of the Discordian materials, but he got busy with other stuff like landscape painting. Really a tuned-in great guy. And so anyway, the years passed, and I'd contact him now and then. Hey, you still cool with me doing the book? He said, yeah. He said, in fact, next time you're down here in Southern California, why don't you stop by and I'll give you everything.
Wow.
I didn't know what everything was, so we met, and I usually say five boxes of stuff just because it accords to the Discordian law of fives, but he gave me several boxes of material, you know, and which is, you know, out of that has come several book projects and this website, but then
it sounds like the Discordian material chose you.
Well, exactly. But then I asked him again, how did you know to contact me? And he told me he had no idea.
Wow,
so
that's
highly unusual. I'm sure there's a rational explanation, but I haven't been able to find it, so I think Iris had a hand in all this. And yeah, there was all kinds of synchronicities. I wish I'd kept a journal. One short one I'll tell you, and I think I wrote about this in The Prankster and the Conspiracy. A lady named Louise Lacey was part of the early days of the Discordian Society, and her name was, can we say profanity on this?
Go right ahead.
Her name was Lady L. F.A.B., and that was short for fucking anarchist bitch. So that was her Discordian handle, and she worked for Ramparts magazine back in the day, and she was friends with Eldridge Cleaver. And,
wow.
She got that name because there was somebody else on the staff. They saw Louise walking towards them, and she was a anarchist or an anarcho-libertarian, and this fellow said to Eldridge, here comes that fucking anarchist bitch. To which Eldridge said, hey, man, back off. She's a good lady. She turned me on to artichokes. He'd never eaten artichokes. So, anyway, the story, Louise is a cool lady. She lives in the Berkeley, but I went to visit her, and she was looking for this picture of Thornley she had taken in the 80s sometimes. He was holding a harmonica, and she was going crazy, looking all over, couldn't find the thing. And we got talking about other stuff, and she'd was talking about she had done a research project for Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead, a book Mickey Hart did on history of drumming. And she kind of pointed to the book and ran her hand over it. Here it is. And so we left, and she said, I'll keep looking for that photo. It'll pop up. So after I left, it might have been later that night, she pulled out that drum book by Mickey Hart, opened it up, and there was the photo of Carrie Thornley we were looking for.
Wow.
Wonderful. Well, you know, I want to underscore, you know, there's so many elements to the story, but how important synchronicity is to Discordianism and indeed the worship of Eros and the whole thing, because synchronicity, it's almost like, the way I think about it is it's kind of like the equivalent of grace in the Christian church.
Oh.
You can't control it. Sometimes it happens. And it lets you know that there's some other order that's putting things together. But it's also a trick, and this makes it Discordian, because if you start to actually believe the story that is implied by the synchronicities, just the same way if you start to believe all the stories in the conspiracy lore that goes around this stuff as well, you go crazy. So you can't do it. But at the same time, you cannot deny the hand of something peculiar, or at least the perception that there is some hand behind things, organizing things. So it's the experience of synchronicity where it seems like you're inside somebody's story, or there's been a setup for you to have this particular kind of experience, is the perfect example of order and chaos, because it seems like there's a higher order, but if you pursue it, you end up in serious confusion. So it's a beautiful expression of this trickster sensibility that goes along with it. And of course, there's tons of synchronicities in the Illuminatus, and especially in Robert Anton Wilson's wonderful book, The Cosmic Trigger One, where he talks about the way that all of this material leaked into his actual experience, to his daily life. And so I always think of synchronicity as being a key thing. But I wanted to ask you about another element that you brought up with Louise, talking about her as an anarchist. And of course, there is a strong libertarian current going on or inside of the Discordian materials. If there is a spirituality there, it is spiritual anarchism. And to my mind, I think one of the big mistakes or errors that people make when they think about the 60s and the consequences of the 60s and the counterculture and all the experiments and all the chaos is to think about it that it was either left-wing, you know, radicals fighting in the streets, or narcissistic hippies tripping in the woods and, you know, trying to build a commune. Those are very important stories, but there's a current of a kind of anarchism, a kind of libertarianism that veers between the right-wing individualist style and the left-wing collectivist style, but the anarchism is very different than the kind of new left rhetoric, the militancy, the seriousness of the new left, all that stuff. And that actually this is much more influential than people give credit for. So I'd love to hear a little bit, whether it's with Thornley or Hill, just a sense of where that that kind of anarchist strand, how the attitude towards religion is also an attitude towards politics.
Oh, man, that's a weighty question there. But
that's what they pay me for.
You nailed it.
Actually, they don't pay me, but you know what I mean.
You know that, I mean, it's yeah, a lot of people see the 60s as that kind of black and white thing. You're either whatever, on the far left or far right, and there's no in-between. But Thornley was definitely in-between, man. He was always exploring, looking at new alternatives, never happy being in one place. And one of that, you know, he got in when he was in the Marines with Lee Harvey Oswald, is when he picked up on Ayn Rand and became, you know, for a short period, a Randian. Was heavy into that, you know, but then that changed over a period, but he was still interested in libertarianism. And, you know, at one point he got exposed to Marxism and switched over and was a Marxist for a while. It was like he was trying on all these different hats to see which he liked, or took a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and started coming up with his own ideology. And so in the mid-60s, he was the editor of what I've heard was the most cutting-edge libertarian magazine of the day, called The Innovator. And he was that was published out of Los Angeles. And of course, Kerry stumbled into psychedelics soon after. So he was trying to embrace both the left and the right. And he'd have these parties at his house where he'd have hippies and libertarians, and they'd all come together and discuss things very, for hours and hours. So he saw, he was trying to merge those two sides together to come with, with something, a position that was more anarcho-libertarian, you know.
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny that that whole period in L.A., there's a really interesting chapter in a very interesting book by Brian Doherty called Radicals for Capitalism. That's a history of libertarianism in the United States. And there's a couple chapters there about the sort of psychedelic overlap. And indeed, that whole scene in around that magazine in L.A., there were a number of, like, captains of finance who started to get into meditation and taking LSD. But they're these sort of, you know, they're interested in a world without the state. And, I mean, it's just a fascinating, wonderful, weird mix. And, you know, why I think it's important to kind of mention that political side is when I reread the Principia recently, the thing that I hadn't noticed before when I was younger, and I was reading it more for, a mindgasm, or, you know, just to trip out, or just to laugh, or to, or even to try to figure out the philosophy or the spirituality of it. This time I was like, God, this is so political. It's so much about politics. It's so much about the struggle of what it meant to be, you know, an individual in society, and how we organize that, and how we think about that. And that the spirituality in it is profoundly libertarian. And I do think there is a spirituality in it. And that's kind of a question I had for you. There's one of my favorite letters in your collection is, I'm going to forget the guy's name now, but Greg Hill is writing the reverend who runs the Universal Life Church, which I'm a minister in the Universal Life Church, because the guy had this vision where he just wanted everyone to be part of, to be a minister, so that they could do marriages or do whatever they wanted to do. And so he made this very radical, very, non-hierarchical model of a church that sort of, like Discordianism, said, you know, you're a pope, you're a pope. And except here, you're a minister, you send him 50 cents in the mail, and there you go. And he wrote, and Greg Hill wrote him a letter because he saw this guy as like a saint. You know, this is a Discordian saint, doesn't even know it. And in that letter, he speaks more straight than he usually does. It's like he's actually trying to explain to this guy what they're doing. And he's saying, look, it's like an art project that looks like a joke, but inside that joke, there's this, you know, there's religious material or spiritual ideas, and that you can't, you know, sort of unwrap one from the other. And this creates this interesting situation of how, is this just a joke? And if it's not just a joke, what is it? What is that extra not just a joke part? And it's really tough, because if you put a word to it, if you say, well, Discordianism is actually trying to communicate a Taoist, Nietzschean sense of, you know, then you're like, no, you're already off. You're already full of BS. But there is also something there, and why I keep going back to this stuff is because it's hard to articulate exactly, because it's like it pulls you into this game, but there's something sacred in the game. That's at least how I read it. I would be really curious to hear how you see that element. Like, what is the spiritual import of this? What is the philosophical, takeaway sort of beyond the jokes and the humor and the sarcasm and the satire?
Well, it is hard to put into words, For me, this isn't going to be anything profound, but I just feel if you accept the chaos in the universe and roll with it, you need to trust that and let it take you where it might. So, and I found that that has worked for me as a Discordian. Of course, Discordianism means something different to every Discordian. That's why, you know, the famous motto, we Discordians must stick apart. You'll find all types, but that's what it means to me as a quote-unquote religion. Like I said, nothing profound there, but, you know, you're talking about, to get into a little bit more, backtrack a little bit on the libertarian-type stuff. That's how Wilson, one of the reasons Wilson, Robert Anton Wilson, got interested in this, because he was, when he was editor at Playboy, he got copies of The Innovator from Thornley, and they started corresponding, and they talked about such things as the anarchist Leander Spooner, I think his name was, started his own mail service back in the day that was, you know, non-governmental. Then you had, you know, they were interested in concepts like that, or Emperor Norton, for instance, issued their own money. So the Discordians would come up with different things, such as they came up with their own currency called flax script or flax notes, and started trading these amongst themselves. So those were type some of the anarchist libertarian type things they were into. And of course, an outgrowth of this probably was one of the last things Wilson was involved with when he was got involved with the guns and dope party in California, that they wanted to elect an ostrich as the governor of the state, if you remember that.
Yeah.
I'm jumping all over the place. I have, you know, it's hard to put into words, once again, the religious implications of Discordianism, because it's going to be different
right, for everyone.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one thing, just also, I feel compelled to mention that the way in which Discordianism played with the great bugaboos who still rule the conspiratorial imagination, and of course, I'm speaking of the Illuminati. And it's actually kind of interesting we made it this far, Adam, without mentioning the Illuminati, because of course they're very aware of what we're doing right here. Now, and but the thing that I discovered from your book that I didn't know about, wonderful story, and I know it's we don't have much time here, so it's we can't go too far, but is how Robert Anton Wilson and Carrie Thornley started screwing with people in the JFK investigation that was taking place in Jim Garrison's office, precisely through this idea of the Illuminati. Can you tell us that tale?
And a campaign they started called Operation Mindfuck. yeah, as quickly as possible. Garrison, and I also have another book coming out on the Garrison investigation in Carrie Thornley later this year from Farrell House, but Garrison was coming up with all these different theories. People were feeding him different theories, and one of his unofficial investigators was this guy named Alan Chapman, who gave him information that the Bavarian Illuminati was involved with the JFK assassination, which is the type of stuff that came out of the Birch Society during that period. And so when Carrie Thornley got wind of this, they started Operation Mindfuck and came up with their own Bavarian Illuminati letterhead, which they'd send to different people, like, you know, folks on the Garrison investigation, confirming that, yes, indeed, the Discordian Society is aligned with the Bavarian Illuminati, and, you know, they're going to take over the world, etc. Nomer Khayyam Ravenhurst, a.k.a. Thornley, is involved, and just to screw with them, basically. And so at one point, Garrison began to believe that the Discordian Society was some type of CIA front, which, of course, you know, Thornley and Wilson, those guys, encouraged this ever the more with all of these Operation Mindfuck hijinks.
Which included an exchange of letters in the letters column in Playboy, in the Playboy forum, which you also include in your wonderful archival collection, which is so beautiful because, like earlier, Maja mentioned Lovecraft and the way that, like, you know, part of the reason Lovecraft's universe is so powerful and still with us today is because he turned it into a game where he'd invite other people to play, that other writers would use the same mythos, or they would play with the names of the deities, and it became this kind of open game. And part of the game works by blurring the categories of fiction and reality, or fiction and actuality. And in a brilliant way, and that's one thing I really got from your book, is how much they were also very, in all sorts of different ways, using letter campaigns and writing, you know, things and making claims and counterclaims, were also saying, hey, we can blur this line between fiction and reality, between religion and skepticism, and by doing that, create a kind of collective game that has no boundaries, that nobody's really in control of, that we don't know how far it's going to go. And it's a really, really beautiful move. And again, it all kind of comes out of that. You know, it really reminds you how much that the JFK and the conspiracy around JFK is the background for a lot of stuff that comes out of the 60s.
Yeah, well, I couldn't have said it better myself.
Well, we got to wrap it up here. I want to thank you, Adam. I want to send people to, in addition to the website that is your name, Adam GoReilly, there is the great website on the historiadiscordia.com, which is also the name of the wonderful book. And it sounds like, what's the name of the Jim Garrison book that's coming out on Feral House?
It will be called Caught in the Crossfire, Kerry Thornley, Oswald, and the Garrison JFK Investigation.
Fun stuff.
Yeah, there's...
and also, you wrote a terrific book about Manson, so Shadow Over Susanna. It's a great book. Thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Super, loved it.
Great. All right, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.